afternoon. His name is Charles B. from Las Vegas.
Another one.
I'm an addict. My name is Charles. Hi. Thank God I'm clean, and thank God for Narcotics Anonymous, and thank you guys for the warm welcome. And I'd like to thank the California Mid-State Regional Convention Committee for asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I'd like to thank everyone who greeted me and welcomed me so warmly. And I'd like to start by sharing that I love Narcotics Anonymous. I love our fellowship. It saved my life. It gave me a life. I had absolutely nothing to share with anyone when I got here, but you are the ones who gave me something. And it's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to give back what was so freely given to me. And I'd like to welcome anyone who's new, and I'd like to welcome anyone who's ever felt different. I'd like to welcome anyone who's not just ever felt different, but felt less than, felt like they didn't belong, felt like they were never a part of, felt like everyone had the secret to living and enjoying life, and they were whispering behind, this is how you live and enjoy life, just don't tell Charles. That's how I spent my whole life before I got up to Narcotics Anonymous. And in our literature, it talks about, you know, we could not live and enjoy life as other people did. We had to have something different, and we thought we had found it in drugs. And if you ever felt like that, if you ever felt like you just weren't happy, you just didn't feel like everyone else looked on the outside, if you've ever felt like that, welcome to the place that you've been looking for your whole life, because that's what I found here in Narcotics Anonymous. I love this fellowship, and what I've also learned since I've been here is that, you know, loving Narcotics Anonymous will not keep me clean. It takes work to stay here. Regardless of how much I love this fellowship, if I'm not willing to do the work, then I'm not going to stay here. And with that being said, I'd like to welcome anyone who's been in our fellowship for a long time and you haven't been doing the most loving thing for yourself by working with the sponsor and working the steps and being of service. Welcome. You're in the right place, and I'm glad you're still here. But before I go on with my soapbox and continue on with whatever it is I'm continuing on, I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about where I came from before I got to Narcotics Anonymous. I'm one of those addicts who believe that the disease of addiction is about a lot more than just using drugs. I believe that the disease of addiction was prevalent in my life a long time before I ever picked up that first one that I picked up. And I believe that I may have even been born with this disease. You know, I don't know if the way that I was raised is responsible for me being an addict, because I know that I had cousins who were raised in the same environment. I was an only child, so I didn't have any other brothers and sisters, but I definitely came from a family. If you want to know anything about my family, watch shows like The Cosby Show or The Brady Bunch. And that shit was nothing like my family. Nothing that I don't even know if it existed at all, but that was not my family. If you want to know what my family was like, watch those shows and think the opposite. Think about, you know, Claire Huxtable smoking crack. Like, then maybe you'll have an idea of how my family was. And the reality of it was that I grew up and I was born to two people who maybe should not have had children, but the bottom line is they did, and I was it. I was the child that they had. You know, I was my father was an addict and he had this disease, and my mother was not an addict. However, she was definitely obsessed with men who were addicts. And my first memory of growing up is the first thing that I can ever really remember is my dad standing over my mom as she's beaten and bloody with a glass vase about to smash it into her face. And that's kind of that set the tone for the rest of my life. You know, and that's the way that I grew up, is in an abusive household. And as time progressed, my mom divorced my father when I was really young, and she went on and she married five more times after she divorced my father. And most of those guys were addicts, but all those relationships were abusive. They were either beating her or they were beating me. And, you know, that's my story. That's the way that I grew up. And I know that there's someone out there who can relate to that, because all of us were victims of abuse in one form or another before we got here. Some of it was physical abuse. Some of it was sexual abuse. Some of it was verbal abuse. Some of us were victims of that little shit that we didn't even know was abuse until we got here and started working the steps and realized this is no way that anyone is supposed to live. And why have I been letting people treat me like that my own life, even after I grew up and moved out of my parents' house? People that I've been allowing people to treat me less than my whole life. And wait a minute, I've been treating myself less than my whole life. Most of us didn't realize that we were victims of abuse, even if the abusers were us before we got here. And that was that was my story before I got to Narcotics Anonymous, is that my mother was constantly in and out of abusive relationships. And what I can remember thinking when I was a kid is, for me, the disease of addiction isn't the drug. The disease of addiction is the voice in my head that talks to me in my own voice. Tells me that I'm not good enough, I never will be good enough. When I think about it, I never have been good enough. I'm no good, and it's never going to work out, so just forget about it. And when my mother was in and out of all these abusive relationships, I kept thinking, if I was just a good enough son, then my mother wouldn't have to be in all these abusive relationships if I was good enough. It was all about me. That total self-centeredness of the disease of addiction was prevalent before the drugs ever came into play. It was all because I wasn't good enough. My father was a using addict and probably wanted to be around and probably wanted to be a father, but this disease impairs us from doing things such as, using drugs sharply affected our ability to love and be loved. And my father probably wanted to be around and be a father, but he just couldn't because he was in the grip of this disease. And I didn't know that at the time. I just thought that, you know, if I was just a good enough son, then maybe my father would be around. If I just played sports like the other boys, then maybe my father would be around. That's what I believed. And so my father would make all these promises to show up and come and get me, and I would believe him. And my mom would sit me outside, and I'd have my little suitcase, my little clothes ready. And, he'd say he'd be there at noon, and noon would turn to two would turn to five would turn to 8 o'clock, and my mom would have the horrible job of coming outside and bringing me in the house and telling me that he wasn't going to come. And one more time, I just wasn't good enough. And, my mom lived, I'm from Los Angeles, and my mom lived in predominantly white neighborhoods in Los Angeles, and my dad lived in Watts, L.A. And when I went to school, my first year of school, what I can remember thinking is, I'm better than all these kids, or all these kids are better than me, and they all know that they're better than me. I was never good enough. And, I was the only black kid in the schools that I went to, but I really didn't notice much of a difference because it was the only thing that I knew. But, apparently, eventually one of the kids called me a nigger and another kid called me a nigger, and I didn't know what it meant at the time, but I knew it probably wasn't good. So I decided maybe I wanted to move with my dad so I could be around more black people. So for the first time, I moved from my mom, who lived in, San Fernando Valley. I moved from her house to my dad's house, who lived in Watts, L.A., and how many of you guys know how well that worked out? Because by that time, I spoke much like I speak now. I pronounced my words very well. I was very articulate. Plus, I listened to fucking music like Metallica and Guns N' Roses and shit at that point. And so, I went to school, and my first day of school in Watts, L.A., what I can remember doing is getting up in front of the class and saying, "Hi, my name is Charles, and I'd like to sing a song for the class," and this is in Watts, L.A. So, they tore my little ass off every day on a regular basis after school, but I did learn how to fight. But, I come from a poor family, and this time they weren't making fun of me because I was black. They were making fun of me because I wasn't black enough. See, that's what the disease of addiction does to me. Today, because I've been here for a while and I've worked the steps, I know that there's nothing wrong with the way that I speak. I'm very proud of the way that I speak, and I'm very proud of my... But the disease of addiction can take something as good as that and twist it around and say, you know what, you're not black enough. And that's the thing. They call me black on the outside, white on the inside, Oreo, house nigger, Uncle Tom, all that other stuff, every name that you can think of. So fuck, now I can't even be black enough. I'm just not good enough no matter what I do. I'm just not good enough. So if you're here and you felt like you're not good enough your whole life, welcome. You're in the right place. We understand. We understand what it feels like to never feel good enough no matter what you do. We understand. But the solution is in the 12 steps. All I wanted my whole life was to feel on the inside the way that you looked on the outside. And the first time I got that feeling, I was a kid, I was really young, and it was getting loaded with my dad. And I'm going to tell you the drug that I use, and it's the only time you'll ever hear me mention a drug that I use, because I believe there's a newcomer sitting out there who wants to hear me say that I use crack, so they can say, "Oh, I didn't use crack, I'm heroin, I use heroin, I'm better than." Or they want you to say, "I use heroin," so they can say, "Oh, I was just a speed freak, I'm better than." In Narcotics Anonymous, we focus on the similarities, not the differences. But I'm going to tell you the first drug I ever used was a drug called alcohol. And that's the first thing that I ever put in my body, and I believe it's important to let you know that alcohol is a drug, period. There's no such thing as drugs and alcohol. I love when I hear that. I don't use drugs and alcohol, and I don't eat fruit anymore, I just eat apples. I don't understand what the difference is. So that's the first drug I ever used, and the first time I ever put that in my body, What I can tell you was that, you know what, for the first time, it didn't matter that I wasn't white enough. It didn't matter that I wasn't black enough. It didn't matter that my clothes came from secondhand stores, that my shoes had holes in them. The only thing that mattered was, for the first time in my whole life, I felt on the inside the way that you looked on the outside. And that's the feeling that I got from the first time I used it. From that first time, I made a commitment that no matter what happened, I was going to keep that feeling no matter what. No matter what, I was going to feel that way. And I didn't know what no matter what meant at that time. I just knew that no matter what I had to do, I found the secret. This must be what you guys were doing this whole time, because you guys all were happy. I found the secret. I know the secret handshake. No need to whisper behind my back anymore. I found it. And, you know, so I was getting loaded, and, you know, I didn't feel different anymore. And, as my using escalated, you know, I got into junior high, and, you know, like around the time when other boys were checking out girls, I wasn't doing that. It just wasn't like what I was doing. However, in the sixth grade, we had this gym class, and we'd be showering with the other boys, and I was definitely checking that out. That's for sure. And so, you know, I was like, something is wrong here. I remember thinking, like, what's the deal? And so one more time, I wasn't different. See, the thing about the disease of addiction is, any difference I have, it doesn't take that as uniqueness, it takes it as less than. I'm not just different, I'm less than. You know, and so one more time, I was different. And so I grew up, and I used to cover up the fact that I felt like I wasn't good enough. I used to cover up the fact that I was gay, and I come from a very Christian-oriented home. And that's the stuff that I used behind, just because I didn't feel like I was good enough. And, you know, the using escalated, you guys all know what the story is. I was dropping out of high school. I was getting arrested every other week. And by the time I was 13, 14 years old, I decided that it was okay for me to leave home. And I decided to run away from home. And I lived out on the streets. And I hitchhiked from one side of town to the other. And while I was in those cars, I did whatever it is that 13, 14-year-old boys do with people who pick them up, who hitchhike from one side of town to the other. And that's the way that I lived. And what I can remember thinking every time that I got arrested, or every time that I was in a car with some strange old man, is, how the hell did I get here? Like, how did this happen to me? This was not supposed to be me. It wasn't supposed to be my life. I didn't know how. And that was not the worst part of active addiction. You see, at that point, I cared. I cared about the fact that I didn't have a place to stay, that I was hurting myself, that I was hurting everyone who ever loved and trusted me. I cared about the fact that I was being degraded, that I had come to a point of dereliction that our literature talks about. But there came a point, not too long after I started using, where I just didn't care anymore, and that is the disease of addiction. That's what dereliction is, when I abandon myself. When I just don't care anymore. When I don't care about the fact that I haven't showered in, for weeks on end. When I don't care about the fact that I left the home with a loving mother, even though she had all of her faults and made all of her mistakes when she was in parenting, but she loved me. I don't care about any of that stuff anymore. I just don't care about me anymore. So what do you do now? I wanted to live, but I didn't know how to do that. I wanted to die, but I never had enough guts to pick up a gun and pull the trigger or slip my wrist or pop a handful of pills and call it a day. But I can remember every time I did that one particular drug that I did, praying, God, please let this be the one that ends it. Because I just don't know how to live. And I don't want to go on feeling. The drugs weren't covering up the feelings of insecurity and inadequacy anymore. They weren't the fix anymore. So what was the fix? I couldn't find it. And I couldn't die no matter what happened. It just didn't seem like it was working for me. And so I got down on my knees and I prayed to a God that I didn't believe in to send me something that was going to help me stop hurting other people and to send me something that was going to help me stop hurting myself. And I have to tell you that 2 weeks later I found myself here in a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. That's where I was. That's what Narcotics Anonymous is to me. Narcotics Anonymous is a gift from God, a gift that I prayed to that God that I didn't believe in. You know, and I found this fellowship, and, you know, they suggested a few things. They suggested you get a sponsor, and you work the steps, and you go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I couldn't go to a meeting every day for 90 days because I had this really busy career that I was working on. I had this 20-hour-a-week job at Burger King, and that's just like my schedule just did not permit me to go to a meeting every day for 90 days. So I didn't go to a meeting every day for 90 days, and they said to get a sponsor, and I was like, I don't know, stuff. And so I didn't do that, and then they suggested that you work the steps. I can't work the steps without a sponsor. So I go to meetings whenever I want to go to meetings, and I don't work the steps, and I don't have a sponsor, even though I'm not doing any of that stuff, I still feel free to come into a meeting and grace you guys all with my pearls of knowledge with 4 days clean and no sponsor, no meetings, and with 2 weeks clean and with 3 weeks clean, and all of a sudden I got 28 days clean and I'm hanging out with some people that are getting loaded, and it sounds like a good idea, and so I do it. And one more time, how the hell did I get here? Wait a minute. You didn't have a sponsor. You didn't work the steps. You haven't done anything except for not use. If you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to keep getting what you got. And that was the bottom line. And so I went like that for a year, wondering why I wasn't going to stay clean. And so I decided that, you know what, I need to surrender one day. And if you guys had told me just surrender when I got here, I wouldn't have known what that meant. But it was broken down to me that surrender means when we tell you to get up, you do what we say. That's surrender. Do what we say. Don't try to worry about the definition of surrender. You just do what we say. And you know what? If you show me an addict who says, if you tell me what to do, I'll do the exact opposite. I'll show you an addict who hasn't surrendered yet. Because that's the reality of it, is that when we are beaten and we are desperate, then we're willing, I don't care how you tell me to do what you say, do. I'm going to do it if I'm desperate and I'm ready to surrender. And so they suggested that I get a sponsor, that I go to a meeting every day for 90 days, that I work the steps with that sponsor. And then they said, you know what, forget, just get a sponsor and do what he says. And I surrendered. And I haven't used from that point on. And it's just all been a bowl of cherries since then. I haven't made any mistakes in recovery. But this is actually my favorite part of my story. All that other stuff that I told you about was just for identification purposes. So the reality of it is that was only for identification purposes, because what I get out there is not going to help you stay clean in here. You know, and I could bore you with the war stories and specifics, and there was this one time when I went to blah, 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 but that's not, see, the disease is arrested. The journey begins. Is what happens. And what is the journey? Our literature, that was one of the reasons we read it, this meeting says that when at the end of the road we realize we can no longer function as human beings with or without drugs. That means that I'm using and I'm messed up. I stopped using and I'm still messed up. So I need something different. And what is that something different? That something different is the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. Narcotics Anonymous is not a meeting program. Narcotics Anonymous is a 12-step program. And if I'm not working the 12 steps, I'm not working a program. So I had to get this sponsor in order to work these steps, because I didn't want to use anymore. I didn't want to use anymore. And I knew that even though I was smart, even though I was intelligent, I was not smart enough to stop using. I was not smart enough to know how to stay clean on my own, because willpower alone will not keep us clean. Our basic text talks about that even with the most sincere desire and the greatest of willpower, we still couldn't stop using. Powerlessness means using against our will. Powerlessness means every time I went to cop saying, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. That's what powerlessness means. You know, when you sit around and listen to people share meetings, I haven't been going to that meeting to talk to my sponsor, because, you know, I don't want to use. If I only used when I wanted to use, I wouldn't need to sit here with all of you guys. I'm here because I use when I want to use, I use when I don't want to use, I use when times are good, when times are bad, when I know I should, when I know I shouldn't. I can't help it. And I didn't want to use anymore. And I knew that my best thinking got me loaded and kept me loaded. So I had to start listening to someone else. And so I started looking for this sponsor. And I set meetings, and this woman was sharing, right? She was sharing about all the stuff that I did in active addiction. I said, that's my sponsor. So I decided to walk up to this woman, and I said, you know, they told me, suggested that I get a sponsor, and I'm looking for one. And I said, Michelle, will you sponsor me? And, you know, she looked at me, and she said, I can't sponsor you. I'm a woman. You're a man. And I said, but I'm gay. The rules don't apply to me. Whether you're gay or not, I'm sure you guys all have the reasons why the rules don't apply to you. We all have reasons why the rules don't apply to us. And I said, I'm gay. And she said, she said, you can't be that anymore. Like, I can't be gay anymore. What do you say? I can't stop it. If I could have just snapped my fingers, I would have done that a long time ago. And she said, and you know what I know today is that she was absolutely right. I can't be a gay addict anymore. I can't be a black addict anymore. I can't be an addict who got clean when he was young anymore, because I will use. An addict is an addict, period. I can't be a gay addict. I can't be a black addict. I can't be a young addict. I can't be an old addict. I can't be a poor addict. I can't be a rich addict. All that stuff, I leave all that stuff out there at the door. When I come in here, I have to be just an addict. I have to focus on the similarities and not the differences, and that's what I know today. But then when she told me that, what I was thinking was, fuck her. So I went and I asked another woman to sponsor me, right? And she told me no, too. And I went and asked another woman to sponsor me, and she told me no. And pretty much I asked every woman in the Southern Nevada area, Narcotics Anonymous, to sponsor me. And anyways, none of you bitches will sponsor me. So I had to go on, and I had to find a man that was going to sponsor me. And I got me at a crazy meeting where there were people throwing chairs across the room and sleeping, and you slept with this newcomer, and you slept with that newcomer. And I loved it. That's what kept me coming back. It was all the drama. And Narcotics Anonymous has been my favorite soap opera. You know? That's been it. I came back to see who was sleeping with who, and who was going to beat who up, and da-da-da-da-da-da, and all that stuff. But and that stuff is interesting to keep you coming back. But you know what? It won't keep you here. It won't keep you here. You know, if you're coming back because of who you're sleeping with, I'm glad. If you're coming back because of the gossip, I'm glad that you're coming back. But the only thing that's going to keep us here is a firm foundation and the steps and a relationship with the loving God that we come to understand through a process of working steps. And so I saw this guy in there, and he was really quiet, and I never heard him share. But it was like, he was non-threatening and non-intimidating. And a lot of times when we come in meetings, we have to be heard, and we have to be voiced. Sometimes it's like, it's intimidating, man, and there were a lot of people in that meeting who were hip, slick, and cool, and had the jive talk, and the bottom line was, to me, it didn't look like they were doing anything different than what they were doing outside. That's what I came in here to escape. I came in here so I didn't have to pretend to be hip, slick, and cool anymore. I came in here so I didn't have to pretend like I had it going on anymore. I came in here so I could just be me. And this guy was just, he was just him. He didn't care how he dressed before he went to the meeting. He didn't, he didn't talk like they were talking out there on the streets. And I felt like I was comfortable with him. And I never heard him share. I don't even think I said hi to him. But that's how the 12 steps work. When I have recovery and I work the steps, I don't have to tell everybody that I do it. It kind of just shows. And my third step, where we say, God, take my will in my life, guide me in my recovery so others can see your will in me. And when we work the steps, when we work the program, other people can see a loving God working through us. We don't have to tell everybody. And so I asked this guy to sponsor me, and he said yes. And he said under one condition. See, there isn't, for me, when I got here, there was no unconditional, there was no unconditional sponsorship. Sponsorship is about working the steps. And if you're not working the steps, then why should we lie and pretend like we're in a sponsor-sponsee relationship? Because we're not. If my sponsor co-signs me working, not working the steps, he's not, I don't believe he's doing me a service. I believe he's doing me a disservice. And so what happened was he told me to call him every day, and I was desperate because I didn't want to use him anymore, so I called him every day. When he told me that he gave me a step and told me to go home and write on it, I was desperate and I was dying, so I went home and I wrote on the step. When he told me to come over to his house and share it with him, I went over and I shared it with him. What happened, through a process of working these steps, I started to develop a relationship with this man that I haven't had with any other man before, that I hadn't had with a woman before, that I hadn't had with my mother or my father before. But I was scared going into it, because it's a scary thing asking someone to sponsor you. It's even scarier when they give you a step and you have to write the innermost thoughts and feelings and fears on and share them with this person, because you know they don't understand. Because you know they're going to reject you. And he did understand. And he did reject me. And we started working the steps and we started building a relationship. And you know what? Thank God none of those women agreed to sponsor me. Thank God. Because if they did, they would have been robbing me of the most intimate relationship with a man that I would have ever had. And I believe as men, that's what we do when we sponsor women in this fellowship, is that we rob them of the opportunity to develop the most intimate relationship they would ever develop with another woman. That's what we do, is we do them a great disservice when we do that here. And men sponsor men and women sponsor women. And that's the way they go. It doesn't matter whether you're gay, straight, black, white, hermaphrodite, I don't care what you are, you need to have, well, I don't know, hermaphrodite, but bottom line is, you know what, men have men sponsors and women have women sponsors, because it doesn't have anything to do with I'm going to have sex with my sponsor if my sponsor is in the opposite sex. It has something to do with the fact that I've never liked me, and I've never liked men because I've never liked me, and once I start working the steps with this man, I began to develop a relationship with a man, and I began to develop a relationship with me. And when we do something different, we're robbing other people and we're robbing ourselves. And so I started working the steps with this guy. And the only thing that I shared with him was that's the only time I was ever honest with my sponsor. The first year I was clean is when I wrote on the steps, because I knew, you guys told me that if I wasn't honest in these steps, then I wasn't going to stay clean. So I went to meetings every day, and I rolled on the steps, and I called my sponsor every day, and I never told him I was gay. I was in a relationship for the first year I was clean, and when he asked me about the relationship, I would say stuff like the other person and so-and-so. I never said he because I was afraid that he was going to reject me for some strange, odd reason. You know, I didn't know why, but I was just afraid of rejection. And we have a pamphlet called the self-acceptance pamphlet, and I used to think that, you know what, if I wasn't gay, maybe I'd have a little bit more self-acceptance. And if I didn't come from a poor family, maybe I'd have a little bit more self-acceptance. If my family were the Huxtables or the Bradys, maybe I'd have a little more self-acceptance. But through working the steps and reading that pamphlet, what I know is the problem is that the stuff that's going on the outside, the problem is on the inside. The problem is something that was always there. The problem was, it didn't matter whether I was gay or whether I was straight, whether my family were the Mansons or whether my family were the Huxtables, I would have always had a problem with me. And so I needed to do something different. I needed to start working the steps. And that's what I did, is I started working the steps, and I realized in the first step that I was powerless over the disease of addiction. And I have to tell you that I don't go to any other fellowship. Narcotics Anonymous is enough for me. And the reason why Narcotics Anonymous is enough for me is because of that first step that we work. It doesn't say we were powerless over alcohol. It doesn't say we were powerless over crack cocaine, over marijuana, over crystal meth. It says we were powerless over the disease of addiction, which is obsession, compulsion, denial, and total self-centeredness, and self-pity in every single area of my life. And I wrote more than just about using drugs in my first step. I wrote about how I was powerless over the disease of addiction in the area of using drugs, how I was powerless over the disease of addiction in the area of relationships, how I was powerless over the disease of addiction in the area of gambling, how I was powerless over the disease of addiction in the area of spending money and lust and all that other stuff. That's the stuff that I wrote about in my first step, and I got to learn about the disease of addiction, right? Now, I'm just getting clean, and I knew that I needed something, and I started working the steps, but I was empty on the inside. You know, and what do we do when we're empty on the inside? Do we call our sponsor? Do we write on the steps? Do we start to pray and develop a relationship with a loving God? I'm not talking about what we do now. I'm talking about, you remember when you were new. No, we don't do any of that stuff. We get a dog, or do we get into a relationship? Let's see. I got 90 days clean, and you're giving me an option of I'm lonely, and I feel like I'm missing something in my life, and you tell me go to meetings, write on steps, talk to your sponsor, develop a relationship with God, or get into a relationship. Which one am I going to go for? So when I had 90 days clean, I called my sponsor and I said, you know, I'm thinking about getting into a relationship. And he said, how serious are you thinking about it? And I said, well, we're moving in together tomorrow. Because that's how we do things around here, right? We, you know, we meet, we sleep together, and the next day we change names and move in together. And that's pretty much what we do, you know? Because when I thought, there was still something wrong with me on the inside. I still thought that there was a problem on the inside. And if I let you have enough time to get to know me, and I don't trap you in this relationship right away, you're going to realize what that something is, and then you're going to leave. So what I do is not only do I trap you in a relationship, but I trap something that I don't even want. That's why it's suggested that we wait until after, I don't know where all this wait till after your first year of recovery comes from. You know, wait till after you do a fourth and a fifth step to think about getting into a relationship, although most of us don't do that. And it's okay because we all have our process to go through. But, you know, because I end up picking someone, here's how a normal person would do. They would meet someone and they'd say, you know, I like this person and I'm thinking about being in a relationship with them. What we do is we wake up one day and we say, I think I want to be in a relationship today. You'll do. And that's how I did propose my relationship. And so, you know, after I trapped this poor individual in this relationship, I realized that, God, I didn't even want what I had trapped. Now I'm in a relationship with someone that I don't know, someone that I don't want, and it's all just because, you know what, I will do anything to avoid feeling my feelings. Anything to avoid being alone and looking at me. I feel empty inside. And what happened was that relationship was just like every relationship I ever had in active addiction. You know, and that's the reality, is that we come in here and we choose, when we're new and we don't have the steps in our lives, we choose the same person that we would have chosen when we were out there, because nothing's changed. Nothing has changed. That's what I tell guys that I sponsor who have some time and they decide to get into relationships with newcomers, and they're like, oh, well, she's cheating on me. And she's like, What else does she know how to do? You didn't give her any time. You better watch out. Because she's going to say queen, probably, but you probably won't. Because you have to feel all the feelings that you're feeling right now. And so, you know, I didn't know what to do. And the reality of it is, can you turn a hooker into a housewife? Yes. But not in 30, 60, 90 days, you can't. So give us some time. So, I'm in this relationship with 90 days clean. He's using. I'm trying to stay clean. We're living in my house. And you know, the same stuff that went on, because I didn't know, you know, he's sleeping around on me, and all I knew how to do was sleep around on him. That's all I knew how to do when I got here, was meet somebody I don't like, and this relationship wasn't working out for me. And what I realized today is when relationships like that don't work out, sometimes it doesn't even have anything to do with the other person. What it has to do with my motives for getting into that relationship was so you could fix me. And all of a sudden, you don't fix me anymore, so there must be something wrong with you. So I gotta go. Wait a minute, it's my house. You gotta go. Well, wait a minute, I can't let you go because then I might see you with someone else. God forbid. So what happens is I stay in this sick and I stay in this unhealthy relationship. And that lasted for about the first year I was clean. You know what, when I was done, I was just done. I was done with that relationship when I was done with it. And I have to tell you that I learned an important lesson from that. I learned the lesson, just like we can hear it in meetings over and over and over again, but until we start to experience ourselves, our literature says that until we can see to our innermost selves that we're powerless over our disease. I have to experience myself, and what I experienced was the same thing that you guys have been sharing with me the whole time, same thing that my sponsor has been trying to drill into my head, that the only fix that there is for me is in the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. And so what happened was I celebrated a year clean in my home group. I came home, packed shit, you got to go. Bye. I'm out of here. I realized that this was wrong. I know you got somebody else. See you later. And I made a commitment to myself that no matter what happens, I was going to dive into the steps because I've always worked steps, but I was going to be in the steps. I was going to learn exactly what place these steps had in my life because I was still empty. When I had a year clean, I was still empty and I was still miserable. I still had something missing. I still had that emptiness that I had inside of me when I was using, and it's because I wasn't trying to fill that void with a relationship with a loving God, because I wasn't trying to fill it with the 12 steps. And so when I stopped working on that relationship with that other individual, what happened was I got time to develop a relationship with a sponsor. I got time to develop that relationship with a loving God. I got time to develop that relationship with me. That's what happened, was I started working on me. And I made a commitment that I was going to live in the steps. That same commitment that I made that I was going to use no matter what, I made a commitment that I was going to live in the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. And I was going to work these steps, and I was going to find out what place these steps actually had in my life. And that's the journey that I began on. And I'd already worked the first few steps, and now I was on the fourth step. And in the fourth step, what happens is we start to take a look at the patterns that perpetuate themselves in our lives over and over and over and over again. And that relationship that I was in, I got into, you know, we didn't have the step working guide then. We had the IP number 10, which is called Working Step 4 in Narcotics Anonymous, and that's what I worked the steps out of. And, you know, I was grateful to do that because what happened was we got to the part sexual relationships, and I got to see that relationship that I was in. I'd been in it 10, 12 times before. You know? It was the same relationship. And I got to see my part in that relationship. And I know I hear a lot of people share about my part was I just showed up. No. You showed up all right. But what did you? Because you know what? If I'm in a relationship with someone who's using and abusing me, it's probably because I want to cover up the behavior that I'm living in. And the reality was I got to take a look at my behavior, why I stayed in the relationship, the behavior that I lived in, because I didn't know how to do anything different. And I got to start to take a look at Charles in the fourth step. And I went over to my sponsor's house to share this fifth step with my sponsor. And what happened was I felt really like cut open and raw on the inside. I believe that the fifth step is surgery of the soul. That's what happens when we start working the steps, when we get into steps 4 and 5 and 6 and 7, is we start to do some surgery on the soul, and it's going to feel uncomfortable. It's not going to feel, I hear people, oh, I left out of my fifth step and I felt so free, and I didn't know I had any defects when I got to my sixth step. Because after I got, I don't know about your sponsor, but I'm sitting there doing the fifth step of my sponsor, and he's like, you did this, and this, and this, and this, and you got this defect, and that defect, and that defect, and that defect going on. And so, you know, I started, I did my fifth step with my sponsor, this man who I was starting to develop a relationship with, and, you know, I started to go into the sixth step. And for me, the sixth step is the most freeing process that there is here in Narcotics Anonymous. Because what happens? Let's start to take a look at the defect, at a defect of character. What is it? What's behind a defect of character? Is it fear? Yes. Is it sick pride and ego? For me, I'm going to deviate from the sixth step a little bit, and I'm going to talk about sick pride and ego. For me, sick pride and ego means that, you know what? I'm going to look good in front of you guys even if it fucking kills me. And it will kill me. And I had about 7 years clean. I started my sharing by saying I love Narcotics Anonymous, and loving Narcotics Anonymous will not keep me clean. When I had about 7 years clean, I still love Narcotics Anonymous just as much today. But loving Narcotics Anonymous won't keep me clean, because for a period of time I stopped doing the work. When I had about 7 years clean, I stopped doing the work. I was still working with guys that I sponsored. I was still going to meetings here or there, but I kind of stopped taking a look at myself in the steps. And if you're not working a program, then you're working on a relapse, is what's happening. And so I stopped going to meetings, and I started going hanging out with people that were hanging out after work. You know, and they were using, they were getting loaded. And it was so glamorous when they were using. Have you ever known, like, those commercials where those people just drink this much wine out of the glass and all this? And you're like, what the fuck are you going to do with that much wine? Well, anyway, I was watching these people drink this much wine out of the glass, and I was thinking, I'm a lot smarter than them. I can do that, right? And but I can't do that because I'm an addict. And after a while, what happened was I developed an obsession to use. The obsession to use can return any time that I'm not working a program. And you know what? I can use without having the obsession to use. You know, and so, but God forbid I go into meetings and I share about that. Because I wanted to look good. That's what sick pride ego is. I wanted to look good. Even if it killed me. Even if it meant I had to get loaded. I had to save my face. How many of us are saving our faces today? Not me. Not me. And why? Why would I save it for your sponsee? Because believe me, they already know how fucked up you are. And they're talking shit about you behind your back anyway. So you may as well go into a meeting and front yourself off. You know, at least I know that's how my sponsees are. And so, you know, 7 years clean, I had to walk into a meeting and I had to share that, you know what, I have an obsession to use because I've been being dishonest and deceitful with my sponsor, and I have stopped going to meetings, and I started hanging around people that use. And I didn't feel comfortable after I shared that, but what happened was it saved my life. You know, what I want to talk about is the defect of judgment. My sponsor shares that if you want to know what heaven on earth is like, try to go 24 hours without judging anyone. You might not want to go to a meeting that day. Try going for 24 hours without judgment. I want to tell you something about judgment. Is that for the first several years I was clean, I judged people for dating newcomers and for sleeping with newcomers. And I mean judged them harshly. I had guys that I sponsored that I let go and told them that I could no longer sponsor them because they were dating newcomers, and I had friends that I disassociated myself because they were dating newcomers. I had people that I persecuted and fought outside of meetings because they were dating newcomers, and they could no longer be my friends because they're a piece of shit and they're worthless because they're killing the newcomers as soon as they walk through the door. So when I had about 6 years clean, let you know where this is going, when I had about 6 years clean, I was sitting in this meeting, and there was this guy sitting in the meeting next to me, right? And I didn't know who this guy was. I'd never seen him before. And the second tradition came around, and I pulled out a dollar, and it was just like it had some kind of dye on it. The dollar was pink. And I said, oh, look, to the guy. I said, my dollar's pink. And he goes, it's not pink. It's fuchsia. And I was like, really? It's fuchsia, huh? I said, yeah. I said, oh, let me buy you basic text. So what happened is I said, how long have you been clean? And he said, 3 days. And I said, here, take this basic text, keep coming back, and you got a sponsor? Yeah, good, go talk to your sponsor. And I walked away. Should have left it at that. right? Because see, that's how I work my steps. It's not just about being powerless. I'm powerless whether I want to admit it or not. And if I'm powerless in the area of love, then I need to act powerless in the area of love. It doesn't matter whether you're gay or straight. All of us in this room know there are certain newcomers that we just should not be talking to. Because we can't help them. See, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions for a reason. Anonymity doesn't mean that I don't tell what you share in a meeting or I don't tell anybody that you're an addict. Anonymity means is that, you know, when you walk through that door, you're nothing but an addict to me. It means that you're not a gay addict, you're not a straight addict, you're not a black addict, you're not a white addict, you're not a rich addict, you're not an addict who can give me something, you're not an addict who can get me a job, you're not an addict who I can get sex from. You're just an addict. And if I look at you as anything else except for an addict, you could die. So if I'm looking at you as anything else than other than an addict, then I need to stay away from you. You know, and so I did. We're still sticking with the defect of judgment here. Follow me, stick with me for a second. So, you know, anyway, I should have left it at that, but I didn't. But I saw him at another meeting, and I said, oh, a few of us are going over to my house to play some spades. You want to come? And so, yeah, we went over to my house and played some spades, and everybody left except for me, him, and somebody else. And I was like, oh, guys, you got to leave now. Give me your phone number before you leave. Maybe we can call. Call me if you want to use. And, you know, so then the next fellow we called, talked on the phone for a little while. And so, you know, anyway, to make a long story short, the next time he came over, it was by himself and I was by myself. You know what happened, and before you know it, I'm sleeping with a newcomer. Now, let's take that defect of judgment. See, that's how the disease creeps in through the back doors when we judge each other. And when we look at each other, and you're such a worthless piece of shit because you're doing this, because you stole money from the seventh tradition. Because you're sleeping with a newcomer. Because you dropped the seventh. Because you dropped the service commitment. Because as sure as I'm judging you, I'm going to do whatever it is that I'm judging you for doing. And if you haven't done everything that you judge someone for doing, then you just haven't been clean long enough. So what happens is now I'm sleeping with a newcomer. And since I've set it up so that everybody who sleeps with newcomers is worthless and a piece of shit, what am I? What am I? Maybe we shouldn't judge. Because now I'm worthless. Now I'm a piece of shit. And that's right where the disease wants me. The disease of addiction wants ammunition so it can shoot us out of here. Doesn't want us to say, I got a disease. Wants to kill me by any means necessary. So what could I do? I had a couple options. I could keep it a secret, or I could get honest with you guys. I could tell him to go talk to his sponsor about it, or I could say, don't tell nobody about it. Oh, as a matter of fact, I'll sponsor you. But the thing about it is that, you know what? I had a firm foundation in the steps. That's what I had, was I had a foundation in the steps. And when you have a foundation in the steps, I mean a real foundation in the steps, and you're used to applying the steps, and you know the freedom that comes along with working the steps and practicing the steps, and you know the imprisonment that comes along with living in dishonesty and deceit, there's really no option. So now what I had to do was I knew I had to go into a meeting and I had to share what it was I was doing. That's what my sponsor used to say to me. You know, if you think what you're doing is not wrong, then why don't you go to a meeting and share about it? You know, and now I knew I had to go into a meeting and I had to share about what it was that I was doing in front of all these people that I judged, right? That's the funniest part, because you know they come out of the woodwork, right? And so I had to go into a meeting, right? All these people sitting in there that I judged, I told, I can't be your friend anymore because you're sleeping with a newcomer, and I can't sponsor you anymore because you're sleeping with a newcomer. I had to go to all these people and I had to share, you know what? I don't feel good about myself right now because I judge people who slept with newcomers and I'm sleeping with a newcomer right now. And I know that you guys are telling me that it's probably not going to work because he hasn't had time to work on himself, and that in a year from now he might realize I don't even want to be with you anymore because I didn't know what I wanted when I got with you in the first place. And I'm nodding my head while you're telling me that, but in the back of my mind I'm thinking, you just don't understand. We were meant to be together. You know, you guys know, right? No, none of you guys have ever done anything like that. And so I had to go into a meeting and I had to share that. And I didn't feel comfortable. I felt really uncomfortable sharing about that. But it's okay to feel uncomfortable. We don't have to feel. I'm not supposed to feel good all the time. That's one of the lessons I've learned in recovery is, you know what? God's will is for me to do the right. It's for me to do what feels right. And what feels right doesn't always feel good. Surrender is not always convenient. So, I had to go in this meeting, I had to share honestly, and I didn't feel uncomfortable, that's okay. Because our disease grows in the dark and it dies in the light of exposure. Honest sharing is the antidote to our disease thinking. And so what happened was I went to a meeting and I shared about where I was and I got some freedom. You see, it wasn't the action that was going to get me loaded. It was the shame and guilt that was going to get me loaded. It was dishonesty and the deceit that was going to get me loaded. And so, you know, just to tell you what happened with that relationship, I stayed clean and he stopped working with his sponsor. He got loaded. And I went and chased after him for a little, oh, come back. And, you know, sit outside of his house and make impressions to see all the people coming in to use. And, you know, they call that stalking. So, I mean, I know those of you are laughing because you've done it. You know, and that's what I did. Now, the reality of it is, would he have stayed clean had I stayed out of his way? We'll never know, will we? See, we can't make anyone use no matter what, but we can put someone in some no matter what situation. You know, and so that's the lesson that I learned from that. And I believe that when newcomers come in here, that they're supposed to try to sleep with us. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to, the newcomer women are supposed to run around half naked with no clothes on, look at me. And the newcomer men are supposed to walk around with the chest out. You know, newcomers don't, remember the days when newcomers used to come in here looking toe up? It was so much easier to stay away then. They don't come in here looking like that, no. They got some new shit out there that preserves you, I guess. But, that's what they're, newcomers are supposed to come in here and try to get attention. That's what they're supposed to come in here and do. But you know what? Even though they're supposed to come in here and try to sleep with us, we're not supposed to give in to that. Narcotics Anonymous is a safe place for me to go. You know, that means that if I'm acting out in lust when I'm in active addiction and I don't know how to stop and I come in here and I'm trying to do the same thing and I'm trying to act out in lust, but I'm hoping, I'm praying that maybe you'll teach me how to do something different and you don't teach me how to do something different. And instead, what you do is you enable me to act out in that same behavior that I was living in out there. This is no longer a safe place for me to be. And so I don't go around and I don't judge people for dating newcomers anymore, but I have set a boundary for myself that I don't do that anymore. And you know what? People who are doing it, I'm going to love them regardless. Because that's what we need, is we need love. When we're living in disease and we're living in defects, we need to be loved. That's what this fellowship is about. And that's what I learned from that situation and other situations of judgment, is that, you know what, an addict, no matter what they're doing, and believe me, I'm an addict like everyone else, and I'm just as opinionated as the rest of you, but we need to be loved. We need to be told the truth, but we need to be loved. And we don't need to be judged out of here. We're each other's eyes and ears. We're the examples of the things to do, and we're the examples of the things not to do. Sometimes we're the only truth each other are going to hear. And, you know, I'm okay with people telling me the truth today. I'm okay with it. I'm not scared of it. It doesn't hurt my feelings like it used to. I know that you're coming from a place of love when you say, Charles, maybe you should take a look at this. I know that. I'm okay with it. In active addiction, I surrounded myself with people who were going to tell me whatever it was that I wanted to hear, even if it meant it killed me, as long as I was still their friend. And I did the same thing. I co-signed everyone's shit in active addiction. My relationships weren't about what I could get from you. They were about what do I have to give up to keep you in my life. And my relationships don't have to be about that in recovery. Through the process of working the 12 steps in Narcotics Anonymous, and only through that process, who I learned to build and develop healthy relationships. And today, some of the healthiest relationships I have are the relationship that I have with my sponsor, the relationship that I have with the guys that I sponsor. And I have the privilege of sponsoring many, many, many men in Narcotics Anonymous in my area and in other areas. And those are relationships that are based on the 12 steps. And that's why those relationships work, is because they're relationships that are based on the steps. And if you're with a sponsor and you feel like your relationship isn't working and you don't have that connection and you haven't been working the steps, that's probably why you don't have that connection. That's because you haven't been working the steps. For this addict, that's the only way to develop a relationship with a sponsor is through the process of working the 12 steps. You can't help but develop a relationship with a sponsor if you're working the 12 steps and if you're being honest with that sponsor. You know, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to move on from judgment. You know, I'm not going to talk about all 12 steps because there's not enough time, and it really is boring when someone shares about all 12. It kind of is. Somebody do the first step. But I'm going to, and that's not because one step is more important than the other. It's just because I don't think you want to sit here and listen to me go through all 12 steps. But I'm going to, you know, move down to the ninth step. And I'm going to tell you about the last ninth step I did. Didn't have anything to do with what happened out there. It had everything to do with what happened in here and the destruction that I caused since I've been here, because I leave active addiction and I come in here with no tools how to lead life, and this becomes my playground sometimes if I'm not working the steps. And so, you know, what happened was, just like everybody else, I've lived in a lot of gossip, right? And I loved gossip, especially when I got here. If there was any drama going on, I was like right in the middle of it. And talking about we can't make anyone use no matter what, we can put someone into no matter what situations. There was this guy who's married, and I got in, his wife was sleeping around a little bit, and I gossiped, and I judged him for being married to her, and I judged her for sleeping around. And so, you know what you do? Like, you gossip about people if they're doing something that they're not supposed to do, and you rationalize by saying, we got these eyes and ears around here, so let me talk about you to everyone, and let me hurt you, and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, that's what I kind of did to this guy. And so I got to my ninth step, and this guy had got loaded. Right? He got loaded with about, I don't know, 5, 6 years clean, and I'm writing about it in the eighth step, and I wrote about it in the ninth step, and it was time for me to make this amends. And this guy's back, and he's talked to me every once in a while. For me, the ninth step isn't about saying I'm sorry. The ninth step is about mending the behavior. It's about changing the behavior. It's about, I've worked the previous eight steps. Now, my behavior has changed through the process of working these steps. So now I can go ahead and I make direct amends. I can go ahead and I can make that direct amends. Has anybody ever noticed that nobody makes direct amends anymore? Like, I'm sitting in a meeting, I'm hearing people share, oh, my sponsor told me I don't have to make this direct amends anymore. And like, I never hear about people making direct amends anymore. But the reason why it's so important to make a direct amends, except when a do so obviously would hurt me or somebody else, the reason why it's so important is because I'm an addict who needs to take responsibility for my behavior. I need to be accountable. Because if I'm not held accountable, when I don't take responsibility, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to do it again. So anyway, I have to make amends to this guy who I put in a no matter what situation, and he used behind. I have to make amends to this guy for gossiping and telling the whole fellowship that his wife was sleeping around on him. And how do I do that? I pray about it. I talk to my sponsor about it. And so I go on this NA camp out, and there's this guy standing there. And it's the guy, and he's out on the camp out, and I'm like, great, okay, God, I've been praying for an opportunity to make amends, but I don't know if this is it. So I go, and I'm like, God, send me a sign if this is it. We're all standing around, and he's in the group, and we're never in the same group, and I'm like, okay, God, send me another sign. And so pretty much everybody leaves, and it's just he and I standing there face to face. I'm like, are you sure about this, God? Because I don't want to take responsibility. For me, the hardest amends to make are the ones where I think I've already gotten over on you, where I think you've already forgiven me. Because I don't have to take responsibility, and I don't want to. So what happens is I start taking responsibility, and I say, you know what? I know that you know that I played a huge part in the pain that you suffered before you used. And here's the hard part. I have to take responsibility. I have to own up to that. And then I have to say, now what can I do to make it better? Because that's a part of the ninth step for me. That's just as much a part of taking responsibility as asking, what can I do to make it better? I have to mend the situation. And he said, don't ever fucking talk to me again. And I said, okay. And we don't speak anymore. That was years ago. But that's what I had to do. That's what I had to do was I had to own up and I had to take responsibility for my behavior. And he didn't have to accept my amends. He didn't have to accept my amends. You know, I don't thank you guys for asking me to share when the topic is, you know, the late Saturday afternoon meeting, and then they said, well, you know, we're going to change it to a living and alternative lifestyle and recovery. And then, you know, now it's just a meeting. And I thank God, because I don't know what living an alternative lifestyle and recovery is. I don't know what it is. You know, what I do know is back to that 12th tradition, that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions. And that's why anonymity is the spiritual foundation, because there is no such thing as a gay addict. There is no such thing as a black addict. There is no such thing as a white addict. There's no such thing as a rich addict or a poor addict. There is an addict. That's all there is. But the disease of addiction wants to separate me from you. It wants to separate me from you because I'm black and you're white. It wants to separate me from you because I'm gay and you're straight. It wants to separate me from you because I'm rich and you're poor. Well, I wish. You're probably rich and I'm a little poor. But He don't want to separate. It will look for any reason to separate. It will separate me because of that. It will separate me because I work a program and you don't, or you work a better program than I do. Any reason to separate each other. And you know what? I used to not go to... I used to have a huge problem with special interest meetings when I got clean. I got clean when I was 17. I was the only black person sitting in the meeting half the time. And I was the only gay person sitting in the meeting half the time. And we didn't have special interest groups in my area when I got clean. We didn't have men's meetings. We didn't have women's meetings. We didn't have gay meetings. We didn't have young people's meetings. We didn't have any of that stuff. And I got clean with people who were 20 years older than I was. And you know what? It worked for me. Because what happens is when an addict shares from the heart, sharing from the heart touches the heart. And that's what worked for me. So I'm here to tell you, it doesn't matter how old you are, you can get clean. It doesn't matter whether you're young, whether you're old, whether you feel like you're different than anyone else, whether everyone else in the room is different from you, you can get clean and you can stay clean and you can live this new way of life. And if you're new, I hope that you get that sponsor and I hope that you work in the steps. And if you don't know why you're working the steps, let me tell you why. I had a guy that I sponsored for 6 years. He got killed in a car accident last year. And his wife and him had a 2-year-old little boy and she was 5 months pregnant. And when they got married, she wasn't an addict. And however, you know how that goes. Shortly after, I think I'm an addict. You know, and she came to our fellowship and she got a sponsor. And they had the perfect life before he died. They had the house, they had the cars, she was a stay-at-home mom. And, and she said, I don't know why I'm doing this. I don't know why I'm working these steps. I don't know why I'm talking to my sponsor. I don't know why I'm going to meetings. My life is perfect. But she kept on doing it. She kept on doing it, and what happened was when she had a few years clean, her husband got killed in a car accident, and she was put to no matter what situation. So you don't know why we're working the steps and developing a relationship with a loving God when everything is going okay. We don't know why we're doing it then, but that's because life is going to show up. I didn't get clean so life could stop showing up. I got clean so I could have the tools to deal with life when it shows up, because somebody's going to die. That relationship that's going so well right now ain't going to be going that well tomorrow. That job that I have, I may not have. Something's going to happen, and I'm going to need to have a program when it happens. I'm going to need to have a program, and if I'm not working on my recovery right now, and I'm waiting for that tragedy to happen, then I'm not going to have anything when it does happen. But we have a part in our sixth step, and it works out like this: when the pain of staying the same becomes greater than the fear of changing, you will surely let go. And I'm here to tell you that when the pain of staying the same becomes greater than the fear of changing, those of us who have a foundation will surely let go. But however, when the pain of staying the same becomes greater than the fear of changing, those of us who don't have a foundation might just use. We might not stay here. I can't sit in a meeting and listen to an addict share that it's okay not to work the steps, that it's okay not to be sponsored, that it's okay not to go to meetings. Because that's a deadly message that kills someone. I must work the steps. I must have a sponsor. I must go to meetings regularly. I must constantly look at myself on a regular basis to see where this disease is coming in through the back door. And it could be that one little detail. I know this disease has me by the balls when, you know, I think, I don't have to share about this. I don't have to talk to my sponsor about this one. I got this down. You know, that one little detail that seems so insignificant that I don't have to tell anyone about it. And what is your little detail that you're keeping in the back of your mind? Because I know what mine is. And I know that when I have that little detail that my disease tells me is so insignificant that I don't have to share with my sponsor, I know that's the setup, and I know that the first thing that I need to do is get on the phone with my sponsor and talk to him about it, then get direction whether or not I need to go to a meeting and I need to share about it. Because that's how this disease works. You know, I'm going to wrap up my sharing real quick. How am I doing on time?
10 minutes.
Okay, beautiful. I'm going to wrap up my share. Sometimes I say in conclusion, I was talking to my little cousin one day, and she, my other cousin brought her to a meeting, and I kept saying in conclusion for about 30 minutes, and then I finally shut up. And so afterwards, my little cousin, she goes, Charles, what does in conclusion mean? I said, it don't mean nothing. So anyway, in conclusion, you know, I believe that no matter how long I stay here, no matter how much time I have, and no matter how, I never stop changing, and I never stop growing, and I have to constantly continue to take a look at myself. And what I want to share about is I want to share about every addict belonging here in Narcotics Anonymous, even that addict that I don't think belongs here, even that addict that I don't want to be here, even that addict that I'm pissed off at because you slept with my significant other. Every addict has the right to be here. And if I'm mad at you, one more time, going back to anonymity being the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, that when you walk through that door, you're an addict. You're not an addict that I'm pissed off at. You're not an addict that I used to be in a relationship with. You're not an addict that I slept with someone who I used to be in a relationship with. You're just an addict, and if I don't treat you as such, you're going to die. I want to share about that real quick, and I want to tell you why it's so important that we treat every addict as just an addict, no matter how we feel about them. I had about 4 years clean, and we went out to eat after a meeting, and I asked this guy for a cigarette, and he told me no. And I said, well, why the fuck can I have a cigarette? Give me a cigarette. And he said, because I don't want to give you a cigarette. And I said, well, I don't understand why. And so he jumped up and he grabbed me and he lifted me up and said, I don't have to give you a cigarette, you fucking nigger. And he spit in my face. Right? And so at this point, I'm pissed off. Right? I'm pissed off because I expected everybody at the table to jump up and beat his ass. And now, I go to meetings with a bunch of white people, right? So now when I say he called me a nigger, they don't know how to react. They're like, oh my God, such a nigger. So not automatically, they're like ready to jump on my side because you know it's the word. So, so this guy called me a nigger, spit in my face. So I go to meetings and I start telling everybody, you know how we do it. I start telling everybody, that motherfucker called me a nigger, blah, 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 blah. And I got all my sponsees gathered up against him and I got all my friends gathered up against him. And so it got to a point where he would walk into a meeting and nobody would talk to this guy because he called me a nigger. And I thought, well, good for him. Good for him. That's what he deserves. He spit in my face and called me a nigger. And so then what happened was I went to another meeting and no one would talk to him. And this was like, you know, he didn't really have any friends now. And so I walk into this meeting one day and the only seat open is the seat next to him. So I have to sit down. And I'm still carrying around my resentment. This is like a year later. I'm still carrying around my resentment because I'm justified in being resentful. You know how it is to be justified in being resentful and angry. You know how that helps us so much and allows us to change and grow because we're justified in being resentful. And so I'm justified and I'm pissed off. You know, how long can you be? Being resentful and pissed off is like being outside in the cold. And you have the key right here. And letting go of that resentment is the equivalent of putting the key in and opening the door and walking through the door and sitting down. But I don't want to let go of that resentment. Fuck that key. I can stay out here in the cold for 2 more weeks. How long can you sit out here? So I sit next to him and I've got my arms folded and I'm like, oh, hi, it's me, Charles. You remember the one you sit in my face and call me a nigger? Yeah. And so nobody would share their basic text with this guy, right? No one would share their basic text with him. And it was a voice in my head that said, why don't you share your basic text with him? And I have to tell you, that wasn't my disease. And it definitely wasn't me. Okay, that was no bright idea that I came up with to share my basic text with this guy. I believe that was the voice of a loving God that I've developed a relationship with since I've been here. And, I said, okay, fine. So I shared my basic text with this guy. And he's like, oh, thank you. And I shared in the meeting, and he started crying because his mother was dying. And I have to tell you that not one person went up and hugged him when he was sharing and crying because of the wreckage that I had caused. Because he had broken, that's breaking someone's anonymity. I had broken his anonymity when I wanted everyone else to look at him as something except for an addict. How do I start off being the victim? You know what I'm talking about. When we start off being the victim, how do I start off being the victim and all of a sudden I'm the perpetrator? All of a sudden I'm fucked up. All of a sudden I'm the one that may cause an addict to die. How do I start being that one? And I still had that voice again, why don't you go up to that guy and give him a hug? I can go up to him and give him, he said in my face, call me a nigger. I can go up to him and give him a hug. You see, what happens is the second step talks about a power greater than ourselves that could restore us to sanity. What is the power greater than myself? If I don't have a God yet, what happens is when you and I get together and we start talking, that's the power greater than myself. When we get together for the purpose of recovery and a loving God sits in the middle, that's where the power greater than myself comes in. And I believe that it was the power greater than myself that told me that, but that power couldn't quite work until I took the direction. I went over to him and I hugged him. And what happened was I went over to that guy and I gave him a hug, and I could feel his tears just streaming down my back. That's when a power greater than myself came in. That's when a loving God came in. When ego is in the way, God can't be there. God can't be there if my ego's in the way. It can't. God can't be there if I'm holding on to my resentment. He can't work with that. He can't. And so once I moved my ego out of the way and I went up to that guy and I gave him a hug, I could feel the presence of a loving God, not just working for him, but I could feel that resentment that I'd been carrying around all that time starting to lift. We have a pamphlet called The Triangle of Self-Obsession, and it says, what's the opposite of resentment is acceptance. What's the opposite of anger is love. What's the opposite of fear is faith. I had to practice some love. I didn't have to feel love for him first to let go of that anger. I had to practice the love. If I change the action, a loving God will change the thinking. So I got up and I hugged him and I practiced the love. And then I practiced the acceptance. And after a while, that stuff started to change and I became free. Because life is too short. The guy that I sponsored that died was 29 years old. Man. 29 years old. And life is too short to walk around with resentment and anger. Have you ever seen those frustrated fucks around here with 20 years clean holding on to shit that they could have let go of 15 years ago that they haven't worked a fourth step since then, so they're still carrying it around? You know what I'm talking about. So I didn't want to continue to carry around that stuff. Because life is too short. We're the examples of things to do, and we're the examples of things not to do. I had to let it go. I had to let it go. And I had to love him. That didn't mean I had to hold his hand and go hopping and skipping through the daisies with him. I just had to stop talking shit about him. I had to let go of the resentment. And that means when people say, hey, so-and-so celebrating over there, I don't say, you want to know what he did to me? That means I say nothing. That's how I started to let it go. And when I started to let that resentment go over the years, because that was a long time ago, I've learned how to practice resentment. I still know how to practice resentment. I've learned how to practice love in the place of anger and acceptance in the place of resentment in several different areas of my life. You know, and that's what this process is about, is it's about learning to love other people. And that's what I love about my sponsor, because that's the message that he carries, is he carries a message of love. He carries a message that us as addicts, we're not here to judge each other. We're not here to condemn each other. We're here to be each other's eyes and ears while loving each other. That's what we're here to do. Because life is too short not to. And that's what the 12 steps have given me. You know, and then the last thing I'm going to share about in conclusion is that I want to tell you about, I hear a lot of addicts share about being married in recovery. You know, and what I want to share about is the opposite of that. I want to share about being single in recovery. And I want to share that that's okay. That it's okay to be single in recovery. I've been single for 7 out of 10 years. I've been clean, and then the last few have been consecutive years. But and you know what? It's okay. See, I don't need that outside thing to fix me, but for such a long time that I did. And I thought that just because I got lonely that I wasn't supposed to feel that, that every feeling I felt I was supposed to do something to fix it automatically, immediately. And I found myself in a lot of unhealthy relationships that way. And what I realized through the process of working the steps is that it's okay to feel loneliness. It's okay. It's just a feeling. And it'll pass. I can't tell you how many unhealthy relationships I was in where I was looking at the person next to me and I still felt lonely with somebody laying right next to me. You know? You know what I'm talking about. And so what I realized is that, you know what? A loving God has a plan for my life. And it's okay. And you know, what if I was single for the rest of my life in recovery? I know there's some people like, shut the fuck up, don't say that. You know what? It would be okay. If I left this meeting, if I never got into a relationship again, if I never had sex again, it would suck. But, it would be okay. It would be okay. I mean, would it really, take a look at the life that I've been given here in Narcotics Anonymous. All I wanted was to be loved unconditionally and friends, and I have that. I have more love than anybody I know in my life. So I think that it's okay for me to be single. It's okay. So if you're here and you're single and you're looking at everybody in relationships and it seems like they have something that you don't have, what I realize when I look at you in that relationship and I look at you in that new car, it's not the relationship that I want. It's not the new car that I want. It's the feeling that it looks like you have in that relationship. It's the feeling that it looks like you have in that new car. That's what my whole life has been about, is chasing the feeling. What if I can chase it? What if I can have that feeling without having that relationship? Because obviously loving God doesn't want me to be in one right now, or else I would be. So I probably should start to come to some acceptance of the fact that my life is the way that it is and realize that it's the perfect life for me right now. What if I can get that feeling without that relationship? What if I could do that? What if I could do that through the 12 steps? What if I could nourish the relationship with my sponsor? What if I could nourish the relationship with my sponsees? What if I could work on the most important relationship, with the relationship with a loving God? What if I could do that stuff? What if I could do that stuff and be okay with me? And I want to tell you that what once was a dream is now a reality. I can be happy with me by myself. I am okay being single because my life is perfect today. It's perfect. That's where I've gotten to. And you can get there too. But if you're not working the steps, you're not going to get there. Because that's what allowed me this freedom. That's what allowed me. What I realized is that my life has always been perfect. I just didn't have the steps in my life to show me that my life was perfect. The steps helped me come to a place of acceptance that my life is perfect just the way it is. And it always has been. I am perfect just like the way I have been. And I'm here to tell each and every single one of you that you are perfect the way that you are. You must love yourself. You must respect yourself. You must treat yourself the way that you would treat me. You must. Because you're perfect. You're perfect. A loving God made you that way. You just fuck it up sometimes. Anyway, I love you all. Thank you guys for all the support that you've given me. And thanks for allowing me to share.